from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A dark turn yesterday in the war in Iraq, as supporters of a firebrand young Shiite cleric turned protest into uprising in cities across the central and southern part of the country. Fierce fighting raged as thousands of Shiite followers of Muqtada al-Sadr took over police stations, blocked roads, and rained fire on U.S. troops. American tanks and helicopters converged over seething urban battlefields in Baghdad. At times, the hardline Shiite resistance had the unnerving look of popular uprising. Meanwhile, U.S. Marines continued today to lock down Sunni Iraqis in Fallujah, where last week Americans were mutilated and burned by an angry mob. Simultaneous resistance from Sunni and Shiite Iraqis is what no American planner wanted. Tonight on Point, too few friends and the look of a two-front war in Iraq. We begin in Baghdad, where U.S. officials said today that an Iraqi judge had issued an arrest warrant for the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The warrant was issued months ago when officials implicated al-Sadr in the death of the American-backed Shiite cleric Abdul Majid al-Khoei. Joining me now is Rod Nordland, Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. Rod, what's the latest? Has fighting with Shiite militants there extended into a second night?
Well, it's not like there's widespread fighting. There have been a lot of incidents and a lot of confrontations. Mm-hmm. And Muqtada al-Sadr is kind of creating the impression that there's a whole lot going on. And, I mean, it is quite serious, there's no doubt. But it's not like it's a native uprising. I mean, the riots that we saw in a lot of the cities in the south, four or five different cities, took place, and there was some shooting and so on. But the actors in those incidents were basically his people bussed down from Baghdad and from Najaf for the occasion. And that's something he's done before, and now it's a little more violent and all. But it's not as if the local populations in those places are rising up, at least not yet.
Rod, we're told that in some of the southern cities, when these militants showed up at police stations, the Iraqi police just walked away and let them have them.
I think that, yes, they walked away rather than having a fight. And in a couple cases, in Najaf, I think there were actually some cases of policemen who kind of switched sides in the heat of the action on the streets and so on. And then in these other places, they just they avoided a confrontation with them. And in Basra, for instance, they took over city offices. But in the end, the British Army down there was able to negotiate with them and get them to give them back. So while it sounds like things are blowing up all over, it's not quite that bad yet, but there's definitely the potential for it to become that bad.
In Baghdad, a pretty heavy U.S. death toll yesterday, 7 and now 8 as another U.S. soldier has died, a couple of dozen injured. How exactly did that happen? That's an unusually high casualty rate for one day, Rod.
One day in one incident, and not only was it 8 U.S. soldiers killed in that one incident, but it was also there were also like more than two dozen American soldiers wounded. So it was quite a big operation, and we don't know very much about it. The military's not saying; they're not letting us near the scene. So it's a little bit unclear what happened. But they went in after Muqtada al-Sadr's people in Sadr City. And there was very, very heavy fighting. His people have been trying to take over some of the city offices, or the local offices in that part of Baghdad. Sadr City is a big Shiite slum, used to be called Saddam City in Baghdad.
We read about U.S. tanks there in the marketplaces as the sun came up, about U.S. Fighter helicopters over these urban areas. Are things calm this evening?
More or less calm. There's some incidents. There's some isolated bits of shooting. It's more a kind of standoff in as far as the Shiite conflict goes, and also as far as the operation against the Sunnis in Fallujah. Fallujah is essentially surrounded. The Americans say they've gone into the city without any incident. We don't know for sure. People in Fallujah are saying that no, they haven't. They're basically just encircling the city and blocking it off. But the really worrisome thing is the potential that we're seeing now for these two conflicts to kind of merge into one, and for a Sunni uprising and a Shiite uprising to actually possibly even become one and the same thing, and that'll be really a big problem.
There's clearly a deep backstory to this U.S. confrontation with the Shiite cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr. His newspaper closed down last week. A top lieutenant arrested over the weekend, and more arrest warrants for a dozen or more of his inner circle related to this killing of a sort of competing cleric a year ago. Does the United States intend now to go after him, and did American forces, American leadership there, essentially ignite this? Did they decide that this was the time for the confrontation with his militant forces?
Yeah, they did ignite it. They shut his paper down because it was inciting to violence, they said. Actually, what it was doing was making very wild and provocative statements about the Americans, such as all the killings in Karbala from suicide bombers at the Ashura holiday were actually American missiles, things of that sort. The paper wasn't actually saying, you know, rise up and kill Americans, and that's kind of what they were charged for. So they needn't have done that. And why they chose this time to do it isn't very clear. For a long time now, for 6 months ago, they had wanted to take Muqtada al-Sadr out. But they made the judgment then that they would have just built him up by trying to arrest him and maybe getting into a fight on the streets. And that would have turned somebody who's essentially a nobody in the Shiite scene into a somebody. So they did their best to ignore him. And as long as they could make sure he wasn't causing too much trouble. Increasingly, though, he's been causing more and more trouble. And after he shut down the newspaper, he proceeded to shut down Baghdad to make it basically the city impassable for demonstrations day after day. The convention center, which is where the coalition authorities do most of their business with the Iraqis, was pretty much impassable most of the last week. But then there was this further escalation, and they served warrants on some of his lieutenants. And why they chose this time to do that, I mean, possibly they thought he was just going to become more and more a problem, they had to deal with it. But it's kind of unfortunate to see it happening at the same time as this very serious confrontation in Fallujah. In a sense, they've taken on a two-front conflict. And as I said before, the real concern is that these two forces are going to merge somehow. The radical Sunnis who have been behind the most of the opposition to the Americans so far, and then radical Shia as well.
We're going to look at that tonight. Rod Nordland, thanks for the report. Thanks for joining us at a very late hour there. We're grateful to you.
My pleasure.
Rod Nordland, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with us from Baghdad. We're talking tonight about a troubling glimpse of a possible second front that erupted in Iraq yesterday in Shia-dominated areas of the country. Why are American liberators now being killed by Shiites, Saddam's biggest victims? How can U.S. troops push back, crack down without stirring more outrage? And how will U.S. troops ever leave this divided country? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Charlemont, Massachusetts, is retired Marine Corps three-star General Bernard Traynor. He's an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book The General's War, The Inside Story of the Persian Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, General Traynor.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us from Newport, Rhode Island, is Richard Norton. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport and a close observer of the practical and political challenges now facing the U.S. military in Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Richard Norton.
Good evening. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Bernard Traynor, first two, if I could. Two fronts, in a sense, already, the hope that it doesn't get any worse. If you're sitting in the U.S. commander's seat or in Paul Bremer's seat in Baghdad tonight, how do you go about quieting these two highly volatile fronts?
Well, let me tell you, I'm sure he's puzzling over that right now, and I think the term two-front war is probably pretty appropriate. the last thing we want is to have both the Sunnis and the Shias, or a substantial portion of each group, contesting the establishment of a new regime in the area. And in terms of the two of them collaborating, both the Sunnis and the Shias, that's a possibility, but in that instance, the target really wouldn't be the United States or the coalition. The blood between the two of them on these religious differences is so deep that, in effect, both of them be fighting the other and taking advantage of this situation simply to advance their own particular interest. But in terms of what one has to do, we clearly have to get a hold of this situation and get control of it, because the ripple effect, it can be enormous. Right now, you have a relatively small number of people, both on the Shia side with al-Sadr, mm-hmm. And on the Sunni side with the leftover Baathists. They're relatively small. But if this sort of thing is like a wildfire, if it gets ignited and spreads and you don't stop it, then you're going to see really some really serious trouble out there.
Richard Norton, the word that came to mind in a number of commentators' mouth this morning was Mogadishu and Somalia. Of course, we saw bodies, though not U.S. military, but U.S. contractors dragged through the streets of Fallujah last week, and over the weekend, this apparently quite intense fighting in the slums of Baghdad. Is this a manageable situation or not?
First off, I would be cautious about applying any analogy without looking at it fairly carefully. And Iraq today is not Mogadishu in Somalia. Clearly, the images do call that to mind. But I think upon more sober reflection, mm-hmm. the differences between the two situations are fairly extensive. In terms of is it manageable, I would say, in my opinion, yes. And I would not disagree with anything General Traynor said. I think what's called for, as he says, is a need to get a handle on this. And I think you do that. What you need to do that with, in my opinion, is professional forces that are capable of precision and proportionate response. In the case of Fallujah, I would think that General Mattis, the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, you couldn't ask for a better force and a better leader at the right place at the right time. So I think it can be managed. I think it's a real challenging proposition. I don't mean to sound Pollyannish about this. There may well be more setbacks along the road. But I think it's a situation that needs to be managed if the United States is going to have a hope of achieving its goals in the long term.
How do you stay on top of a situation in this densely populated urban Baghdad, for example, where you've got Muqtada al-Sadr reportedly has thousands, tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 in what he calls his al-Mahdi army. He's saying demonstrations are no longer enough. Terrorize your enemy. And this weekend, that is what happened. Technically, how does the military get in there and pacify this without making more civilian enemies more trouble?
Well, I defer to General Traynor on that, and also I wouldn't second guess General Mattis and his army counterparts in terms of how best to secure and isolate a city and deal with this tactically. And so I'd like to pass that to General Traynor.
Bernard Traynor.
Certainly, it's a problem if you let this get out of hand, and the only way you're going to be able to contain it right now is by establishing a forceful reaction to what is happening. Because if the impression is that they have scared the Americans, whether it's in Sadr City in Baghdad, mm-hmm. or whether it's in Fallujah, if there's the sense that the Americans can't handle this or the coalition forces can't handle it, or that they're afraid, then this thing is just going to go out of sight. So what you have to do is use the iron fist that we've had inside the velvet glove. Now, that doesn't mean that in both instances we're going to go in and knock down the buildings and kill all the men and women and salt the earth so that nothing ever rises again. But it means that you have to make it perfectly clear that you're in there and you will take forceful action to ensure that there's security. One of the mistakes I think we made in Fallujah was for the army forces that were in there to withdraw from the city and allow this sort of thing to fester.
Bernard Traynor, hold the thought. We'll come right back to it. We're talking about the troubling prospect of a two-front war in Iraq tonight with Bernard Traynor and Richard Norton. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about the troubling prospect of a two-front war unfolding in Iraq with Sunni and Shiite militants in Fallujah, in Baghdad, beyond over the weekend. We're joined tonight by General Bernard Traynor, retired Marine Corps three-star general, former Deputy Chief of Staff for Plans, Policies, and Operations. He's now an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And from Newport, Rhode Island tonight by Commander Richard Norton, Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. You can join the conversation as well. How can U.S. troops crack down without stirring more Iraqi outrage? President Bush says he's firm on a June 30th handover of power to Iraqis. Can you imagine that working? And why are American liberators being killed by Saddam's biggest victims, perhaps, the Shiites? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bernard Traynor, the Marines came to Fallujah saying they were going to take a different approach from the Army. They were not going to be as, I'm not sure how to put it, brutal? Or they were going to get back into the city, but do it in a way that showed a friendly face.
Well, I think it's a mischaracterization to say that the Army was being brutal. But
I don't mean to say that, but they were drawing a contrast. Perhaps you can describe it for us.
Well, the Army did have the idea that you try to spot your enemy and go in and make a strike, and they would use a lot of force. And sometimes there was a lot of collateral damage connected with that. That was not the case in all instances, but they did tend to move on the force side more than the diplomatic side. The Marines went in there with a long history of dealing with situations of this nature, which goes back to the Banana Wars back in the 20s and the 30s.
In Central America.
It was summarized in the axiom of the commander of the Marines that are back there now, and that is the U.S. Marines, your best friend or your worst enemy.
Right.
In other words, if you cooperate with us, you will benefit. If you don't, we're going to kill you. If you're going to oppose us and if you're going to try to kill our people, we are going to do a job on you. So they went in there with a male fist inside of a velvet glove. But as we're seeing, we probably have to take the velvet glove off for a while to gain control. But we have to get into Fallujah. They cannot allow this sort of thing to spread. They cannot allow these dissidents to feel that they have the upper hand and they can do what they want within these harbors of insurgency, such as Fallujah. So we have to physically occupy the city and, in a sense, establish a sort of martial law situation. And in conjunction, probably with special operations forces, identify the cells that are a danger, and take them down. The most of the people in Fallujah, they may not like the Americans, but the last thing that they want is the lack of stability and security in their particular village. And I think this is probably true in the Sunni Triangle.
Richard Norton, I think a lot of civilians looked at the images coming out of Iraq last week and over this weekend, the mobs, the chanting in Fallujah and again in Baghdad, and began to wonder if, against all expectations, there's a kind of popular uprising against intended liberators here. Does it look like elements of popular uprising to you? And as a military man, do you look at that and say, well, we can handle that? Or is that something that the military just can't handle?
Oh, it has the potential of being a widespread uprising, and that's what we have to stop. What happens in a situation like that, if there's a perception of weakness or inability to react, then the thing gets out of hand. It's like a horse gets the bit in his teeth.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to make sure is that we take the actions as prudent as possible and as proportionate as possible to reestablish unquestioned control of the area. And when that happens, you know, the people that were waving and desecrating the bodies, they weren't the people that ambushed the vehicles. They were locals who were kind of caught up in the excitement of the thing. You see this sort of thing all the time after a football game or a championship match of one sort or another, where college students go out and burn the automobiles and so forth. They get caught up in the emotion of the moment.
But not usually mutilated bodies hanging from a bridge.
Well, but I mean, the parallel is somewhat similar. It's a mob reaction. And the only way that you can deal with a mob reaction is to forcefully go in there and restore order and security and stability. In Fallujah, they're going to have to do that by going into Fallujah and making sure that they take control of the situation. If you stand off and take kind of a passive attitude or a reaction attitude, this thing is going to spread like wildfire, and we can't afford to possibly have that situation happen, because we don't have the forces in there. We don't have the situation which will allow it. Up until this time, we have been making use of the locals to maintain security and stability in some of these towns. They're not really capable of it.
They walked away from police stations today. Well, not very heartening.
And Tom, you can't blame them. I mean, these people are Iraqis. They live there.
But they're supposed to take over the government June 30th.
Well, that's right. Well, let me tell you, you know, they perhaps will take over the government, but this is going to be a weak government unless the United States and the coalition forces support them completely. So, but I think you'll see in Fallujah, you'll see the Marines go in there. They will also bring in the coalition, or rather the Iraqi security forces, and they will work in tandem so that the poor old Iraqi security forces that are in there right now that feel very threatened and intimidated will have a little bit of support. So the whole idea, insofar as you possibly can, you've got to accelerate the ability of the Iraqi security forces to provide the stability and security in the region, but they can't do it by themselves. We have to back them up. We have to support them. We have to operate with them.
Richard Norton, Bernard Trainer, if you could stand by for just a moment. Dilip Hero is joining us from London. He writes for The Guardian. He's the author of 15 books on the Middle East, including Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. Good evening and welcome from London. Dilip Hero.
Yes, I'm here. And, of course, I also write for the New York Times, the Washington Post, actually.
Yes,
my last op-eds were for the New York Times on the 27th of January. Anyway, I'm here. I've been listening to the comments made by your two guests.
Dilip Hero, here's a question for you. We're hearing tonight Richard Norton and Bernard Trainer both essentially saying the U.S. must get unquestioned control of the situation. Is that doable?
I think, you see, let's take the two situations separately. We talk of Fallujah. I think Fallujah is a very important city. It was in Fallujah a year ago that there was a firefight in which the American forces killed 18 Iraqis.
These were more or less civilians. There was trouble outside of school, and everybody was sorry about it.
That's what happened. Also, just to make some specific things clear, the police, the Iraqi police in Fallujah, openly say we do not work with or cooperate with the Americans. They have incidents when the Iraqi police themselves have been killed by American GIs. I'm
right.
Just giving you a good picture. Secondly, it's very interesting, as you probably know, this movie called The Fog of War, which is a long interview at different times with Robert McNamara,
yes,
in
yes.
which he repeatedly makes the point that we, Americans, failed to empathize with the Vietnamese. We did not know their culture, we did not know their history, and what I am witnessing in Iraq, and I have been studying Iraq for the past 25 years,
mm-hmm.
and I've written, as you said, 15 books, four of these are on Iraq. Now, what really depresses me is the inability to understand. When the Americans killed 18 people, civilians, in Fallujah, they did not understand Fallujah is a tribal society. When you kill somebody, you offer blood money, which is compensation for taking life. No such thing happened. The Pentagon has refused to pay any such blood money, and that is something which the Iraqis don't understand, they don't accept. Secondly, there have been any number of instances where the American troops have gone into homes, broken down doors, and entered what the Iraqi men consider sacrilege, entered their women's quarters,
right.
and handled, you know, their underwear, et cetera, et cetera. And this is something, you know, I mean, you know, from the American point of view, it might be nothing. But you have to understand, you have to get under the skin of being a tribal Iraqi Muslim living in Fallujah. Then you can understand what is it that there's a grievance that is building up. Now, secondly, I just give you a quote, which is not my quote. This is a statement made by none less than Madeleine Albright.
Yes.
And she said, retaliation brings counter-retaliation. and it goes into higher and higher gear. Now, okay, I heard the two military gentlemen, your guests, and of course they think in militaristic terms. We have to establish control. We have to do this and this. You have to do this and this. To what purpose? The whole point, we have to get down to the basics. Iraqis have been, in quote, liberated. Liberated to do what? Liberated to exercise their right of self-determination. Therefore, elections. Now, you might say elections are not possible, but they have a transitional constitution. And do you know a gentleman called Paul Bremer, who is neither Iraqi, nor a Muslim, nor an Arab, says, if you 25 Iraqis sitting in the governing council say in this constitution that Iraq is an Islamic republic, or in Iraq the Sharia law will be the exclusive source of Iraqi law, I will not sign the document. Now, who is he? Is he an Iraqi? Is he deciding this for the Iraqi people? If it is the self-determination of the Iraqi people, if they want to have Islamic republic, it's up to them.
So you're saying it doesn't look like self-determination to the Iraqis. Dilip Hero, stand by. I want to welcome callers on. We've got a lot who are waiting to join us. Rich is calling from Boston. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, welcome.
If I can, I'd like to say something to maybe bridge the conversation between your guests. I was a 11-year veteran of the Air Force. I flew in the first Gulf War.
Okay.
I spent 6 months over there and was fortunate to spend a lot of time on the ground talking to people in Saudi Arabia, which is not Iraq, but at least they're a lot closer to the Iraqi culture than we are.
Yes.
And, you know, I couldn't agree more with what the last guest was saying about really Americans don't understand the culture that's over there. In 5 months of my time over there, I still didn't feel like I really understood them.
But, Rich, we're there, and everybody says we have to succeed, that otherwise Iraq will fall apart, the Middle East will fall apart, there's no choice. So what do we do?
Well, the problem is we have the best – this isn't a problem, but we have the best military in the world. We have geniuses in the Pentagon who have made great policies to understand how to fight wars. And when it comes to conventional –
at
combat,
least on the invasion side, not necessarily the aftermath, but we take your point. Yeah.
That's exactly right. We know how to fight any kind of combat head-to-head, but this is an asymmetric war. It's a political war, and we essentially – think that we can send the military in to fight this political war, when the fact of the matter is that the real war isn't for who's taken a building or a corner. It's for who's taken the hearts and minds of the Iraqis, and that's the war that we're losing.
Rich, we've got it. Let us pick up on that. Richard Norton, I think I hear you there.
I think so.
Yes. How do you put together the military challenge, the political challenge here? Rich spent some time in the Middle East, and he's not optimistic.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that need to be said. First off, I'd like to clarify, I am not an active duty commander. I am retired, much as General Traynor is.
Understood.
I'm simply a doctor of national security affairs at the War College. I'm a civilian.
Yes.
Now, that said, I do think, and I think your caller is absolutely right about the military capabilities of the United States, but I think in some ways there is clearly, it's not simply a military approach to this problem. If you look at what's going on, Sadr does not speak for all Shiites. Ayatollah Sistani, I would suggest, is far more influential in the Shiite community, and we are working with him.
Right.
I think in terms of the asymmetric approach, he's absolutely right. What we're seeing is an asymmetric approach to a military force, an occupying force that is, not to sound chauvinistic, but is unbeatable in symmetric warfare. I think what people have perhaps missed, and General Traynor was talking to this, is that the Marines and indeed some of their Army counterparts are extremely good choices for this asymmetric warfare. The Marines have looked at this throughout their history. Almost a decade ago, they began training in what they called the three-block war, where everybody from corporals on the corners to the senior officers, such as General Mattis and those above him, are at least thinking about these type of issues. As a small example, I would suggest that the fatwa that's been obtained recently against the mutilation of human remains shows at least some sensitivity and understanding of the local cultures. And again, with all deference to your caller from London, I would suggest that it's not as simple as understanding an Iraqi culture. The Iraqi culture is made up of, as he points out, a disparate group of almost a patchwork of different cultures. There are the Kurds in the north, the Shiite in the south, different factions in the Shiite and Sunni communities themselves. And I think General Traynor's right. You have to begin with establishing physical security and stability in these areas, as has been pointed out, where even sometimes the police are against us.
Right.
That may, by the way, entail taking action against civic leaders and police officials who feel it is all right to attack occupation and coalition forces on the street. I think there's a difference between political opposition, which we understand and work with. I mean, Sistani is not necessarily the handmaiden of the United States, and armed resistance and violence, which you cannot let stand. And so I think it sounds easy to say we don't understand the culture, and clearly to understand any culture takes a great deal of effort, but to simply dismiss the diplomatic and developmental side of the U.S. approach, I think is short service to that as well. So I think you have, in many ways, a multifaceted approach, some of which involves military action, some of which involves civic action, and to be honest, there will be dilemmas in this challenge from now into the foreseeable future, but it's not all one way.
Bernard Traynor, do you think that the U.S. military has been handed, is in the middle now of a cultural and political context in which they can bring their training and their power successfully to bear?
Well, we certainly hope so, but I have, Tom, I have to go back, with all due respect to your respondent from London.
Yes.
I think he used too broad a brush when he talked about not being culturally attuned, knocking down doors and disrespecting the Iraqi culture and so forth. Some of that occurred, but it was rather unique. I don't think that was generally the case. And I think the example was up in the northern area where the 101st Airborne Division was, a very aggressive unit. They maintained a great deal of civility, and they used the humanistic approach, backed up by force very successfully, as did the Marines when they were out there earlier in the southern section. Secondly, in terms of the reaction to the Americans as occupiers, nobody likes an occupier, but when they think of the alternatives, I think there's a fair percentage of the majority of the Iraqis probably are tolerant of having the Americans there for the sake of stability. Now, getting to your basic question, though, there's no doubt about it that this is not going to allow a military solution. It has to be a political solution, and it has to include the Iraqis. But the thing is, you can't have any sort of a solution unless you have stability and security. And in that instance, you need the military to do the military things to establish that basic fundamental for some sort of progress.
It's the old dilemma, how you use that military power without undercutting the reception of the population at the same time, establishing that security. Bernard Traynor, Richard Norton, Dilip Hero in London, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're looking tonight at the troubling prospect of a two-front war unfolding in Iraq. How can U.S. troops crack down without stirring Iraqi outrage? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the troubling prospect emerging over the last week of a two-front war unfolding in Iraq, U.S. forces in conflict with Sunni Iraqis and Shiite Iraqis. You can join the conversation tonight. Why are American liberators being killed by Saddam's biggest victims, the Shiites? And what's your strategy for fixing Iraq and getting the heck out? Can you even see the exit? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom is calling from South Beloit, Illinois. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My initial comment was I don't know why anybody's surprised by this, because Bush ran on the idea of being a uniter, not a divider. So the fact that he's got the Sunnis as well as the Shiites against us doesn't surprise me at all.
That's a kind of grim comedy, Tom.
But the ultimate comment, though, is the fact that if he would have gotten the UN involved and gotten more nations than just a unilateral action that he did, maybe we wouldn't be the bad guys and the target for all this. I don't see us, you know, whether we stay there a short time or whether we stay there a long time, I think we're going to be the target for hatred and attacks as long as we're there.
Tom, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call. Dilip Hero in London, what about this notion, this fear of militant Sunnis and militant Shiites making common cause against the United States forces? Can you imagine that? Is that a real possibility?
Well, absolutely. I think you see that, interestingly enough, you know, what your earlier gentleman who called, you know, military planning and political planning. And again, I have to quote Madam Albright here. She made the statement, this mismatching of military planning and political planning by the Bush team. And that's what's coming out very clearly. In terms of what's happening now, what happened over the weekend is extremely important because so far the majority community, the Shiite community, which is 60% of the population of Iraq, was at best quiescent. It was not challenging or confronting the occupation forces.
Quiet,
and that has changed. That has changed. Now, how much support Mr. Al-Sadr has, a different ballgame. In fact, I heard the correspondent of the Newsweek talking about it. See, it doesn't really matter. You don't have to have 51% of the Shiites signing up for Al-Sadr to create problem. Just look where I live, London. From here, we have Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, the population is only 1.75 million.
Mm-hmm.
Minority of them, only 30% are Catholics, and amongst Catholics, only 1 out of 7 vote for the Sinn Féin hyphen Irish Republican Army.
And still there were years of conflict.
The IRA. Even then, the British government has deployed 60,000 security forces to control a minority in Northern Ireland.
But I want to ask this specific question on Iraq. Can you see Sunnis and Shia cooperating to try and push Americans out and then to turn on each other in civil war?
No, I think, I put the other way around. As long as there is somebody to hit, somebody to blame for the problems, which is Americans, I don't think the Sunnis and Shias will fight each other, because they have a common adversary. And if the Americans or Anglo-Americans basically say we are leaving, then that possibility can come up. But as it stands now within the Shia community, as has been pointed out, you know, the Shia community is not a monolith. You know, there are different groups, and of course a Sadr group, and then of course you have another Al-Hakim group. And Al-Hakim group's spokesman was on the BBC World Service. I heard him say that Mr. Bremer, by going after Muqtada al-Sadr, has escalated the situation to a dangerous level. And al-Hakim is with Grand Ayatollah Sistani.
Right.
And these are his words. So I think essentially, yes, these two forces, which so far were not working together, will likely come together only out of sheer self-preservation. And remember, Baghdad... let me just very quickly give the
self-preservation. The United States is not there to kill them. The U.S. is trying to build schools and roads. It may be a matter of pride, but self-preservation.
I think, see, when you say this, you know, that's very interesting, Tom. You said this.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I have one of my books to my credit called Dictionary of the Middle East, which is also called Essential Middle East. In that, there's an entry on 1991 Gulf War. In 1991 Gulf War, 6-week war, the bombing of Iraq destroyed $200 billion worth infrastructure of Iraq. Now,
right,
in the 6-week war, which finished May 1st of last year, the figure of how much Iraqi infrastructure was destroyed by the war and in the looting which followed immediately exists at the CENTCOM, because every victorious country works out how much they destroyed of the military infrastructure of the defeated country and how much of the civilian.
Now, right, so we take your point that a lot of destruction has come along with us. I want to get another call in here if we can. David's calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
Just a quick point or a question to pose to guests. I was wondering if they think any comparisons between what's going on with the United States and Iraq and what happened with the Soviet Republic in Afghanistan. Do we run the same risk of getting stuck in Iraq in the same way the Soviet Republic got stuck in Afghanistan for, I think it was about 10 years.
And a long time.
About 1,000 men a year.
Yeah, a very long time with a high death toll. Of course, the U.S. death toll gone over 600 in the last couple of days. David, thank you for the question. Bernard Traynor, we've heard Somalia rejected as a model here tonight, and clearly this is different. What about Afghanistan and the Soviets? Do we run the risk of being in Iraq for as long as they were in Afghanistan?
Well, that's a possibility. There's no question of it. I think the analogy limps, in other words, to compare us to what the Soviets were doing in Afghanistan, where they were establishing a Soviet government against the wishes of the tribal elders and the people in general.
But, of course, we could be portrayed in that light in Iraq, whether or not that's...
We will be as being conquerors as opposed to liberators. And I think we have to simply accept that. That goes with the territory that we're involved in. But I think, you know, that there are a lot of people that regardless of what we do out there, regardless of our good intentions, they're going to condemn us because we're in there for oil or for some other nefarious reason to support the Israelis or whatever. You get all that sort of stuff. But that doesn't change the fundamental fact that thinking people in Iraq and around the world understand that the United States went in there. They may argue as to whether it was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, but the point is we are at this point. And it's not in the interest of the country, it's not in the interest of the region or the international community for this thing to develop into chaos or civil war or absolute anarchy. We have to succeed. Everybody wants that. Everybody wants that, including all right-thinking Iraqis. Now, there are those that want to disturb that. Some of them are very well-intentioned. Some of them are not. Some of them are simply in a power grab for their own particular persuasion.
Bernard Traynor, we've just got a minute left here. What's the model for success? Is there a model you can point to and say, we can succeed here as some country succeeded somewhere else? What's the model?
That's a tough question because every struggle is sui generis. But, you know, I think the closest I can come to, because it turned out to be a success, but it wasn't without its pitfalls and its problems, that would be the Philippines.
A century ago, you're saying.
That's correct.
With a very high death toll among Filipinos and Americans, for that matter.
Yes, but the Philippines emerged as a viable democracy.
Well, there's a model way back in history. Our time has flown by. Bernard Traynor, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Retired Marine Corps 3-star General Bernard Traynor and Richard Norton at the U.S. Naval War College, thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And from London, Dilip Hero, writing for The Guardian, The New York Times, Washington Post. His book is Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a former embedded journalist reflects on the deaths he witnessed in Iraq 1 year ago this week. This is On Point. The recent surge of violence in Iraq has put not just the lives of soldiers and civilians at risk. In the past 10 days alone, 4 media workers have been killed in Iraq. Since the war began a year ago, a total of 23 members of the press have died there. It was 1 year ago tomorrow that NBC's David Bloom became the second American journalist to die during the war in Iraq. A few days earlier, the Atlantic Monthly's Michael Kelly had been the first. Boston Herald reporter Jules Crittenden had become friends with both Bloom and Kelly while he served as an embedded reporter in Iraq last spring. Crittenden was traveling with a tank company in the Army's 3rd Infantry Division, the same company that led the taking of Baghdad a year ago this week. In this radio diary, Jules Crittenden looks back and remembers David Bloom, Michael Kelly, and the Iraqis whose deaths he witnessed firsthand.
On the ride out to the desert camps, NBC's David Bloom sat in front. I sat behind him. The Atlantic Monthly's Michael Kelly sat behind me. "What do you think, Dave?" I said. "Is this the cool bus or the geek bus?" "This is definitely the cool bus," Bloom said. "This bus is going to 2nd Brigade. Whatever action happens, 2nd Brigade will be in it. Trust me." We talked about our families and showed each other pictures. Then Kelly tapped me on the shoulder. "You're from the Boston Herald?" We talked about taking our kids to ball games. We talked about what we told them. The Kellys told their boys the truth. My kids thought I was on an extended Middle Eastern cultural exchange, to include a big campout with the army. I told Kelly I just wanted to ride with some grunts into war. Kelly was going to dog the commanders for a high-level blow-by-blow. Too bad we never got to see that. 3 weeks of dust and fire later, Kelly and Bloom were dead. I had seen Kelly just days before. He hopped out of an armored vehicle in his baggy chemical warfare suit and beamed at me. We exchanged pleasantries and discussed the day's fighting. Then he hopped back in and was gone. He was killed 4 days later, April 3rd, when his Humvee came under fire and veered into a canal. Then Bloom, on April 6th, dead of an embolism from being cramped in the tracks. At the time, we heard it might be a concussion from a tank's gun blast. At dawn the next day, the soldiers I was riding with would lead the assault on Baghdad. We expected it to be bad. I did the math. Things happen in threes. Third time's a charm. Third man on a match. I'd had two close calls in a week. The first when I nearly stumbled over some Iraqi holdouts, minutes before the GIs killed them. Then, a bad RPG ambush. Now I was the third man. It was not possible Bloom and Kelly could be dead and I would survive. I was already dead. It just hadn't happened yet. Getting killed was part of the deal. We knew that. It was their kids that choked me up. Young kids, just finding out Daddy would not be coming home. It was something they never bargained for. I had a black hole in my heart at the thought that I would do this to my own kids. But the soldiers I rode with had no choice in the matter. If they went and died, I would not be glad to have stayed back and lived. To be dead already is a liberating thing. The pre-dawn fear lifts and you are ready for your day. A day that becomes one of the incomparable days of your life. The days on which your children are born. The day you were married. The day you leave your father's house. The day I expected I would die and went anyway. It was instructive when I learned several days after the assault on Baghdad that to second-guess your options is pointless. Two reporters, a German and a Spaniard, chose not to go into Baghdad that day. They stayed back to follow our progress by radio. So they died there instead, after our tanks left, when the Iraqis attacked the rear. On the outskirts of Baghdad, we opened our track's big hatch and stood up in the dawn. The thunderous tank fire and the hammering of the 50s erupted ahead of us. We were exposed but preferred to see it coming, to be blown out rather than burned to death down below. Flames and black smoke swirled around us. White-hot RPG trails arced overhead. Shock waves rolled over us. I remember the moments when I thought it might happen. RPGs that came too close. A car racing at us at high speed, in slow motion, until a tank's fire stopped him. The zing of a bullet from an unseen gunman. Today, I marked the deaths of men I knew and strangers with whom I'd become intimate. Men whose deaths I witnessed and those three on whom I called down death. You were in the ditch from which we were taking fire in front of the palaces. When I saw you in the shadows not 30 feet away, I directed the 50-caliber gunner's fire on you. I watched you die. Forgive me. We all made our choices when we showed up for work that day. It was your day to die, not mine. But I remember you. I observe the anniversary of your deaths and those of David Bloom and Michael Kelly with the knowledge that this year of life has been a gift.
Jules Crittenden is a reporter with the Boston Herald. He was embedded with a tank company in the Army's 3rd Infantry Division during the war in Iraq last spring. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this